The Carmen Fantasy by Pablo de Sarasate, borrowing music from Bizet's opera Carmen. That was Lila Josefowitz and the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Featuring local and independent artists.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. A little over a year ago, Mr. Dan Wright was on this show, and we're pleased to have him back with some new research and information. Dan has a master's degree in political science. He is retired from the Michigan Civil Service, where he was senior analyst and technical writer in the State Department of Social Services. In 1978, he joined the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON, as a state section director. He is a former MUFON state director, and was later elevated to the International Board of Directors in 1986. He served two terms as MUFON's deputy director in charge of North American investigations. He has authored multiple chapters of MUFON's manual on investigative procedures, and was instrumental in devising computerized case reports. Dan conducted an exhaustive five-year study involving 300 cases of alleged alien abduction. He is the author of Winter Solstice, a novel shedding light on the world's major religions as well as Middle Eastern and American politics while introducing a superior non-human intelligence. And the nonfiction books, The CIA UFO Papers, 50 Years of Government Secrets and Cover-Ups. His latest book just came out, entitled CIA Chronicles, the UFO Files, in which he highlights many of the government's recently declassified documents concerning the UFO phenomenon. He has been featured on many media talk shows, to include George Nuri's Coast to Coast. And I'm proud to say Dan Wright is an old friend of mine, and happy to have him back on We Are Not Alone. So, hello, Dan.
Hi, Dave. It's good to be with you. A small correction.
Okay.
The what you called the title of the new book was my working title. It was later changed by the publisher. So the actual title of the book, as it was published last week, is the CIA UFO Papers.
CIA UFO Papers. Okay. Things change fast.
50 years of secrecy and cover-ups.
Okay. Things change fast. That was the latest info I had, so I'm glad you corrected me. So, how have you been?
I've been extraordinary, and you, Dave?
Oh, I believe that. I've been just as extraordinary. What can I say? But anyway, how and why, tell us, speaking of the CIA, how and why did the CIA form?
Oh, how did it form and why?
Yeah.
During World War II, early on in the American involvement in 1942, FDR became greatly impressed by the spy agencies in England and in France and what they were revealing about German capacities. And he wanted something like that, that at once could learn new stuff about what the abilities of the Nazis were, as well as the Japanese, and obscure and hide American capabilities at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So he put together an office called the Office of Strategic Services, and he put at its head an old World War One commanding general named Wild Bill Donovan. They liked their nicknames back then. During World War One, the American forces were led by Pershing, Cactus Jack Pershing. So
Cactus
they
Jack.
Liked their nicknames back.
I guess,
then.
Yeah.
Anyway, the OSS proceeded to carry out FDR's orders, and curiously, this was not a creation of the Congress. The president had an extensive emergency fund during the war, and the OSS got all of its monies from that emergency fund, mm-hmm. which meant they really weren't accountable. Donovan's signature was good enough to work for a bundle of cash.
Wow.
So they were kind of obscure and anonymous from the get-go, and boy, does that follow as the years go by.
Mm-hmm.
Now, during the war, 43, 44, 45, American and British, as well as German and Japanese pilots, from time to time would report odd balls of light or plasma that would come up and float right along with them, pace their airplane from a little ways off their wingtips. The OSS attempted to call these ball lightning, but, geez, ball lightning needs thunderstorm conditions for starters,
yeah.
And many of these sightings happen during clear skies.
Right.
Plus, these balls of light would travel along with the planes for many miles sometimes, whereas ball lightning is a very fleeting, momentary occurrence.
Mm-hmm.
So, at the same time, none of the pilots regarded these as a menace or an enemy. They strictly felt it was some oddity that they'd never figure out, and it was good for talk around a beer between combat missions.
Yeah.
The pilots, for want of a better term, called these balls of light Foo Fighters, F-O-O, fighters.
Mm-hmm.
And they really did not consider them a menace or an intruder, an enemy. They were just a curiosity to talk about over a beer between combat missions. And the war ended, and so did the Foo Fighters, so to speak. From there, I would take you to 1947, just within a couple of weeks of both the Kenneth Arnold sighting in Washington, state of Washington, and the crash in New Mexico, what we have always felt was the crash.
Roswell, yeah.
Roswell, yes. Mm-hmm. Within just 2 weeks of those events, the Congress passed the National Security Act, which created both the CIA, which was the successor to the OSS, and still headed by Wild Bill Donovan, as well as the National Security Council. And from there, we after a spate of sightings following Roswell through the rest of that year and early into 48, but rather suddenly the reports just petered out. And the rest of 48, 49, 50, and 51 had virtually no activity for whatever reason.
Really?
Then, early in 52, things changed. In March, there was the creation of the, I love this acronym, IFDRB, Information from Foreign Documents or Radio Broadcasts. Kind of covered everything.
They just didn't say how foreign it was, right?
Yeah. And these reports would come in largely from across Europe and North Africa. And they were sent in by operatives, or as we might know them, spies or spooks.
Okay.
Most of their material was classified, and there was a lot of blacking out in these as they were passed on. But here and there, between serious anti-Russian kind of stuff, they would talk about a local sighting of UFOs. Flying saucers was the common term then. But following this, the creation of that in March of 52, things suddenly picked up. Roseville, Michigan, on April 27, three adults saw a silvery oval tumble out of the sky, hover, and leave, and then three silver cylinders meandered overhead. On that same day, there was a sighting for over 2 hours in Yuma, Arizona, with an off-duty control tower operator and his wife in attendance. May 1, George Air Force Base in California. Also in early May, Keesler Air Force Base in Mississippi. Later in May, a rocket-shaped object over Barcelona, Spain. And on the 29th, San Antonio, an Air Force pilot had a sighting. June 1, a cargo ship in a small West African country called Gabon. There, a shipmaster and mate saw something rise up from just beyond the harbor into the sky and then do a series of right-angle turns until it left the area. In early July, an East German father was riding his motorcycle with his adolescent daughter when he got a flat tire. And as he was attending the tire, the daughter brought his attention to something that was going on in a nearby woods. They were curious enough to follow up on it, and they got within 30 feet of a landed saucer and two beings in metallic-type garb outside, or an outfit made of that.
Where was this?
The daughter remarked something to her father, and these two guys overheard it. They raced back into the ship, and it took off with a fiery exit, and they found a depression in the ground where it had rested.
Did you say this was in Italy?
That was in East Germany.
Oh, East Germany. Okay.
Go ahead.
That report came out after the father and his family fled East Germany to West.
Wow.
And in the same month of July, Algeria had reports on the 15th, two on the 26th, two on the 30th, and two more on the 31st. On July 24, the Netherlands had four adolescents saw a V formation of disks. And that all led up to two infamous sightings in Washington itself. The Washington National Airport and the Andrews Air Force Base nearby on the night of July 19 and 20 suddenly had all kinds of blips on their radar. And unfortunately, they could not send up a jet interceptor because Andrews' runways were all being repaved. And so they had sent their all of their jets and the pilots to a base in Delaware.
Right.
Well, when these blips kept showing up, both at Andrews and Washington National, as well as the onboard radars from incoming planes, they panicked a little bit and called the Delaware folks and said, get here when you can. Well, then they really dropped the ball. The jets did not arrive until 3 o'clock in the morning. Now, the blips on radar is something high in the sky that only is known as only an unknown, no particular shape. But as soon as the jet interceptors got within radar range, the anomalies boogied and were completely gone. The jets made a pass over the city and left to go back to Delaware, and as soon as they left the radar screen, back popped the unknowns on radar. And this happened on and off for the rest of that night. And then 6 days later, or 7 days later, on the 26th that evening, the same occurrence with the same result came. Well, that was enough that the CIA director got quite nervous, and he asked the deputy director of intelligence for some kind of answer to it all. That led to an August 14 announcement by the National Security Agency director, who is an Air Force general. He told the press that all that stuff around Washington, D.C. was just temperature inversion. And later that month, the word went out that if they only had better information, that 20% of sightings that were being left as inexplicable would probably all be explained as well.
Yeah, better information,
so
wasn't it?
Famous 1952 series of circumstances.
Wasn't it up to them, the Air Force, to fill in that quote unquote better information?
Yeah, the CIA, now this is important to understand, they wanted nothing to do with this subject because they figured if the public knew that the Central Intelligence Agency was looking into UFO reports, that itself would give them more
credence. Yeah.
And it would be a cause of possible public panic. So they wanted to leave their name completely out of it, and that's how they managed to form an alliance of sorts with the Air Force. And their operations on UFOs out of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio.
Well, was there then or is there now a particular CIA unit responsible for UFO reports?
Yes. The agency assigned all of the work on UFOs to the Office of Scientific Intelligence. And they, in turn, wanted total anonymity from the public and the press, but they did form a group that looked at materials as they came in. By the end of 52, the OSI, Office of Strategic or Office of Scientific Intelligence, they decided that the public was never going to be completely satisfied until hard science was brought to bear. Mm. So they approached a Caltech physicist who was anything but gullible named Howard P. Robertson and had him put together a group that included three more physicists and an astronomer, an expert in radar, and a fellow that you might have heard from before, Alan J. Hynek.
Oh, yeah.
Who, two decades later, he formed the Center for UFO Studies. But in 52, he was a hardcore skeptic, and he was an informal but regular attendee at the Robertson panel hearings. Mm-hmm. From January 14 to 17, they looked for about 12 hours at the what they felt were the most prominent cases. Mm-hmm. One of them was a film from Tremonton, Utah, that curiously was taken by a career Navy photographer. He should know what he was, and using state-of-the-art equipment for its time.
Right.
He said that he saw 12 saucers in his viewfinder and had them there for a couple of minutes. The Robertson panel looked at them and said, yeah, these could be the reflections off a group of seagulls. Otherwise, it might be weather balloons. Uh-huh. Well, it'd be curious for a dozen weather balloons to be flying together. But seagulls, they got away with that as an explanation.
Oh, my goodness.
They looked at one other film from Montana taken by a minor league baseball manager when he was tending his park, and he was gullible enough to turn that film over to the Air Force. When he got it back, a number of frames were missing from what he handed over.
Yeah.
And they, of course, showed the objects, two of them, in the best clarity. The Robertson panel decided that those were reflections from two F-94 jets.
Now, were those frames pulled out before or after Robertson?
Yeah, after he turned it over to the Air Force, somebody clipped about 35 frames gave it back.
You know, it's funny you talk about gullibility. It's funny how people that will not be gullible enough to accept the UFO reality are gullible enough to accept the craziest explanations that don't fit the evidence, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Let me take one moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with UFO researcher Mr. Dan Wright, talking about his new book. But, so we were talking about the Robertson panel. Do you have anything else on the Robertson panel you want to share with us?
Yes, the Robertson panel made six conclusions or findings. First, that there was no threat to national security posed by whatever this was. Second, that in a true crisis, political or military crisis, that casual UFO reports could overload communications and hide actual hostile acts. And furthermore, that they would cause mass hysteria. They also decided, as a third point, that trying to solve most or all of the incoming sighting reports would be a great waste of effort. Mm-hmm. Instead, the Air Force and the Defense Department generally ought to to create a training and debunking effort to train the public to understand that everything they've been looking at and seeing as odd were really normal things misidentified. And the debunking effort would be on those reports that seem to have some substance. They would mock the reporter and debunk the case entirely. Mm. That they felt that by this combination of training and debunking, the public's interest would gradually fade away from anything UFO-related. Mm. They made the point here to, and this is a quote from the Robertson panel report, to take immediate steps to strip the unidentified flying objects of the special status that they've been given and the aura of mystery they have unfortunately acquired.
That's a quote.
And their last conclusion was that civilian groups like APRO, the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, and mm-hmm. its co-directors, the Coral and Jim Lorenzen, should be held in great suspicion and should be surveilled, as well as the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, or NICAP. They did all suspicion NICAP, but gave it grudging respect because it had a prominent group as a board of directors, had 3,500 members, and regular investigations and a newsletter. So they saw that as rather efficient and
too efficient.
Didn't know quite what to do with it, right. But again, right. Should surveil it.
So let me ask you this about, many people, many of our listeners know about the Christmas 1980 Rendlesham Forest case, Bentwaters, yeah. We've had Peter
Rodman. That one has been the subject of, quite a few televised documentaries.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
At a critical point on the second night that something odd appeared, the base's deputy commander, Halt was his name, mm-hmm. he saw it for himself, a pyramidal, a small pyramid-shaped object glowing in the Rendlesham Forest mm-hmm. on the edge of the woods there next to the base. Mm-hmm. And then all kinds of craziness going on in the sky over them. And Halt never backed down. He went on one program after another in the years to follow saying, this is real, I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but what isn't known, not well known at all, is that 28 years before that, Bentwaters had another crazy event where there was nothing seen outside in the air, but these were all radar pickups of a dozen anomalies on the radar screen at once. Mm-hmm. That these coalesced and formed one big blob, which then disappeared. Now, maybe they just shot high into the sky beyond radar range. That's a good possibility. They tracked an object that from 15 to 20 miles southeast of them to almost 30 miles northwest of them in a matter of 30 seconds. Hmm. Well, that would translate to something over 10,000 miles an hour. So it was beyond the capabilities of our aircraft. That report was made and sent up the line, but it never made the final records. Jumping ahead, all of this stuff from the book is from a January 2017 release by the CIA of previously classified reports, including what I've just talked about, that to its website. Until that time, you could, in the years prior to 2017, you could find these files if you had enough gumption, because you had to go to the National Archives, and you had to use one of their four desktop computers to look this stuff up, and you couldn't copy anything.
So it was all
so
secret
I
anyway,
think
right?
It was, I'm always going to believe it was a gift from President Obama to folks like us,
mm-hmm.
that in the final weeks before the end of his second term, he ordered the CIA to put all this stuff on its website.
Yeah.
Now, when they did, they crowed that they had just released 1 million pages on UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my involvement, when I read about that, I called the executive director of MUFON, Jan Harzen, to tell him, presuming he was setting up a group to tackle this gigantic effort, that I would join the effort. And he said, actually, no, no one has, but you're certainly invited to put one together if you care to.
Now, were you ever in the service, Dan? What did we learn in the service? Never volunteer for details.
Never volunteer, yeah. So I thought, well, before I start prevailing on some other folks to help me tackle this gigantic project, I should get the lay of the land first.
Mm-hmm.
So I dug into them, and it was not a million pages of anything.
Oh.
It was a little over 100,000 pages, but literally 98% of it was not UFO-related at all.
Oh.
If you wanted to know all about the rail tonnage in Bulgaria for the year 1956, it was there, as well as everything else under the sun. It was as if there was this UFO pile, and any kind of report, any information they didn't know what else to do with, they'd throw on the UFO pile. So it grew exponentially up to 100,000 pages, but 98% of it was fluff.
Wow.
In the end, I had 550 documents and files to work with, totaling a little over 2,000 pages, and that's what the book comes from.
Well, the book isn't 2,000 pages.
Oh, heavens no. Well,
the book is like
But it is over
300.
I do have almost 50 pages of endnotes. I wanted this to be a research work for future ufologists.
Right. Yeah, I noticed there's a lot
of... about a little over 300 pages of text, I guess.
Yeah, over 300 pages and a lot of endnotes and a lot of, places you an index and you can cross-check things. And you you really not only did your homework, but you put in the information to let the reader do their homework. You know, if they don't believe a certain case, well, here's the... here's the information where I got the information from. Check it out yourself, you know? So I got to congratulate you on that. So,
thank you.
So what is this? You mentioned in your notes here, ham sandwich.
Ham sandwich.
What is that all about?
My kooky way of talking about a couple of guys that were at the center of this for a while.
Okay.
There was a fellow named Leon Davidson. He was a nondescript chemist at the Los Alamos Laboratories. I mean, an important job, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
He heard about a broadcast on ham radio in Chicago that some local fellow had apparently tape recorded. And Davidson got it in his head that this had to be not Morse code, as people were telling him, and what it actually was, but rather a message from space aliens. And he badgered the Central Intelligence Agency for 5 years about this.
My.
He demanded a copy of the tape. Failing that, he wanted a translation of it. And he went from one office to another to the point where these poor folks in OSI within the agency were swearing off him, saying directly in memos, "We want nothing more to do with this fellow." So he probably used up somewhere around 1,000 hours or so of CIA's staff time.
Jeez.
Then there was, at the same time, this is 1956, and by then, NICAP had been taken over by Donald Kehoe, who was a retired Marine major. So he had some creds just because of that. And from the get-go of his taking over the directorship of NICAP, he used the newspapers and magazines at every turn to say, "Cover up! the government is covering up what it knows. Mm-hmm. And so he was a real thorn in the backside of the agency as well. So combined, I figured that they had done a ham sandwich on the
agency. I see. Well, you've got to admit, there are such things as conspiracy theorists, but it's not a conspiracy if it's true, you know? But the conspiracy was they were trying to keep this from the public. Do you agree?
Yes.
Okay.
In July of 1962, the Air Force put out an infamous regulation. It was number 200-2, and it required that base commanders at Air Force bases no longer speak to the public or the press about anything UFO-related unless it was identifiable. Mm-hmm. If it was Venus, or a temperature inversion or whatever, they could say that. But if it was truly unknown, no, all they could say is, we've taken it under advisement, we'll get back to you later. And, of course, they never would. But that was the directive for the base commanders. Other personnel on the air bases, and now we're talking pilots, radar operators, they could not say anything without prior permission from their commanders, and on a need-to-know basis only. Mm-hmm. That put a real pall over the future for any military-related report of unidentified.
All right.
Now, as that was coming out, a retired Navy admiral, Roscoe Hillencoder, who by chance had been the CIA director in the late 40s for about a year, but was now in NICAP on their board of directors, he started speaking out in response to this menacing 200-2 regulation. He said at a point, behind the scenes, high-ranking Air Force officers are soberly concerned about the UFOs, but through official secrecy and ridicule, many citizens are led to believe the unknown flying objects are nonsense. The Air Force has assumed the right to decide what the American people should or should not know. Now, that's from a former CIA director. That was powerful stuff.
What year was that, Dan?
That was July of 62, the same month that this AS Reg 200-2 came out.
So up to 62, they were more or less admitting that UFOs are real, and then all of a sudden they did 180, right?
Yes, although I wouldn't call it 180, maybe more like 10 or 20 degrees, because the agency and the Air Force had always said that they said, well, we're only leaving 20% of them unexplained. And then they reduced that to only 10%. And eventually they said, we're explaining everything but 5%. And if we had better information, those would be IFOs as well.
Well, yeah. If they had better information, they'd know exactly
if
what
they
are.
Had better information. Yeah. Now, in 66, a Dr. James McDonald, who was an atmospheric physicist at the University of Arizona, he was quoted at length in an article in the Arizona Republic that was titled, UFO Hush Blamed on CIA Men. McDonald said he came to the conclusion of an ET hypothesis for UFOs as what he called the least unacceptable explanation.
Really? Really?
And he said, to his satisfaction, whatever this all was, it was a peaceful reconnaissance. And that the 1953 Robertson panel report had orchestrated an Air Force debunking. Now, the Robertson Report, at least as condensed, was made available to the public in 57, I believe. But what McDonald had seen, he went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where Project Blue Book was well underway, and he read through the Robertson panel report, but attached to it was a memo from the CIA director to high Air Force officials ordering them to debunk UFO reports from then on. And McDonald was just all over that and accused the Air Force and the CIA of intentionally covering this up. Continued to address this in sessions with the Arizona professors and students. Later on, a gathering of the National Weather Service. He was getting some real airtime for his accusations, but eventually it came back to haunt him. His own university superiors came down on him. His wife left him, and despondent, he took his own life.
Yeah. Was that questionable at the time, or did they actually believe he took his own life?
No, I think he had. I didn't read anything to suggest that it was other than a suicide.
Suicide. Okay. I need to take one more moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we are speaking with UFO researcher and author, Mr. Dan Wright. So we were talking about James McDonald. Anything more to add on that?
Yes, just among his accusations, he really took apart Project Blue Book. He called them a scientific scandal, and that their assertion that they were able to resolve 95% of all UFO reports from the public was nonsense. It was utter rot, he said.
Utter
that
rot.
It was closer to 50%.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
yeah, I like to...
You know, I ended that particular chapter by saying, rest in peace, Dr. McDonald. You did some good.
Yeah. I like to call Project Blue Book Project Whitewash. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
So, how did the National Photographic Interpretation Center become involved?
Yeah, NPIC. That was an arm of the CIA.
Okay.
And on behalf of the Project Blue Book and the Condon Committee, it invited for a visit the Dr. Edward Condon, who was a Caltech professor, he was at the University of Colorado.
Yeah.
And the Air Force, by 66, they were ready to punt on all things UFO related. They couldn't explain it all. They were embarrassed. and they were being ridiculed openly by the public. And so they were ready to get rid of it. And they formed a contract with the University of Colorado to conduct an 18-month serious study of all things UFO related.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a couple of curiosities about this. He brought in five physicists and three psychologists to do that work, and they did form and continue to periodically look at the stuff over that year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
But even before they got underway, a Dr. Robert Lowe, who was a Colorado staffer, he told university officials, our study would be conducted almost exclusively by non-believers who would add an impressive body of evidence that there is no reality to the observations. Mm-hmm. And now the key word. He said the trick would be, I think, to describe it so that to the public it would appear to be a totally objective study. But to the scientific community, it would represent the image of a group of non-believers trying their best to be objective, but having an almost zero expectation of finding a flying saucer. So much for Dr. Lowe's objectivity. Now, Dr. Condon himself, Edward U. Condon, he declared when they were about a month or two into this study, I won't believe in outer space saucers until I see one, touch one, haul it into a laboratory, and get some competent people to go over it with me. He also told the press, it is my inclination right now to recommend that the government get out of the UFO business. My attitude right now is that there is nothing to it, but I'm not supposed to reach a conclusion for another year.
I'm not supposed to say that for a whole year.
Yeah.
Which I just said.
So the Condon Committee and its report, which led to the ending of Project Blue Book, the report came out in early 68, and by the late in 69, limping along with one officer. And this is never been known even by people who followed Project Blue Book. It never was a good-sized group. There was, at best, a major, oftentimes a captain or lieutenant, but just one officer, and then like a sergeant and a secretary. That was Project Blue Book. And they were supposed to follow up on reports from 100 different military bases, from the Pentagon, and from the public.
And then there was
including the secretary.
Yeah, but there was Hynek, which was a civilian, right? Hynek was a civilian, correct?
Oh, of course, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Now, I think they chose him because he was so skeptical.
Because he was skeptical. And he said later on, you know, when I came into the science craft as a young man in 1948, I, along with every other scientist, thought UFOs were nonsense. But with my occasional work with and for Project Blue Book, my skepticism gradually disappeared.
Mm-hmm. And then he spent the rest of his life trying to prove that UFOs do exist.
Did exist. He founded the Center for UFO Studies, which now bears his name, the J. Allen Hynek Center, in 73, and he'll be missed as well. I had the great good fortune to spend an evening with him back in the 90s. He was in Jackson, Michigan, looking for a possible site for a UFO museum. He didn't settle on that, but he was staying in a hotel that evening, and myself and another fellow regaled him with our local investigative stories.
and he
was a good man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's good to be skeptical, but at least he had an open mind.
He was pretty much a nice guy as well.
That's what I say. I don't believe it. You'll have to show me evidence, and then I actually look at the evidence, you know. And that's what he did. Which was great.
In wrapping up its work, the Condon Committee said, perhaps we need a national magic agency to make a large and expensive study of all these matters, including the future scientific study of UFOs, if any.
Magic agency.
Magic agency. And before that, a CIA skeptic had said, you know, I know this professor at Columbia University who's an expert on magic and all kinds of chicanery. Maybe we should get him going.
Thought it was all a trick, huh?
So, you know, it's been an uphill battle for us, Dave.
Well, now with the Pentagon's admission that UFOs are real, they've been studying them ever since they said they weren't studying them, and provided video evidence, that along with your book that took all the fluff out of the CIA reports and presented the hard evidence. Well, yeah. What do you think they're going to say? You know, I mean, what do you think?
I think they're going to go out of their way not to say anything more. I've been waiting for a knock on my door by two men in black, but
it hasn't happened yet, huh?
Yeah. But, you know, they always insisted on anonymity for what they considered a good reason. The public would panic if they knew the reality of it all.
And yet, I've mentioned this before on the show, that France has admitted to their people long ago. Mexico and Colombia, a lot of
American countries.
Yeah. They've admitted to their people, you know, this is real. And some of them say, oh, really? Others say, yeah, we know. But they go on with their lives. You know, they're not panicking in the street.
A couple of decades ago, Russia set up an official hotline for anybody in the country to call. And that was a government-run hotline on UFOs. So we're kind of out there in the bushes by ourselves with all this denial. But I don't think the CIA or the Air Force is going to have anything to say in response to a book like mine. They just want it to quietly go away. It never has, but they keep hoping.
Well, the book, like yours, is not just a book. It's an omission. It's the files from the CIA files. They can't deny their own files. Well, they can deny their own files. In fact, our government has a great history of saying, you know, I didn't say that. We have it right here in the black and white. We have it on tape. I didn't say that. But at any rate, okay, so how do you think people are going to react? There's
undeniable evidence
that UFOs are real, over and above the CIA files in your book, over and above the Pentagon's admission, the video evidence. How do you think they're going to react to the truth?
The agencies, I don't know. They'll try to ignore it as long as possible, but for greater society, if there was just an undeniable admission, even if it's non-intrusive, if it's just stuff high in the sky watching us, that's going to cause some at least short-term impacts on our society and everyone around the world. For starters, I think stock markets and currencies would have a major hiccup, probably tumble, because people that delve in stocks and bonds and that stuff, they hate uncertainty. And there's nothing more uncertain than our future with the prospect of some technologically superior race staring at us.
Yes.
I think people would be less likely to buy life insurance. That wouldn't pay off for decades. To even buy a house, which doesn't really pay off in the short term. Now, there would be some winners. I think canned goods would do a great business. Beef jerky would probably fly off the shelf because people will start living on more of a day-to-day basis, not doing anything long-term. I think travel trailers and campers and tents would be sold at a much greater rate as people are gearing up for some possibility of having to desert the home and go somewhere.
Go where? It's like the radio show Orson Welles, The War of the Worlds. People were leaving their homes and going. Where are you going? They don't have a clue. Where do you hide?
Just go somewhere.
Let's go.
Now, there would be some impact on some of the world's religions, and I would start with Christianity. The Bible doesn't mention anything about alien beings, and it does say Jesus was the only begotten Son. So who are these guys? That would cause a major rethinking of the Christian faith.
Well, we could...
Judaism, I don't know whether that would have an impact or not. Islam is still a monotheistic religion, so there might be some rumbles there, but, say, Hinduism, which is polytheistic, would open arms to some alien race. And non-theistic Buddhism probably wouldn't have a problem either.
Well, they say there are those who say that the Bible is one of the best books on UFOs ever written.
And there will be wonders in the sky.
Oh, yeah. Ezekiel's wheel.
That's in Revelation.
Ezekiel's wheel within a wheel, you know. The
wheel within a wheel.
And so many eyes and yada, yada, and a lot of...
That's Old Testament stuff. The New Testament sticks by this only begotten Son.
Okay.
If he was the only begotten Son and we know what he looked like, who are these guys with the big eyes and the big head?
Well, what are we?
Yeah.
So
there would be some other kind of cultural consequences. For, I think, by the millions in a helter-skelter fashion, families would come back together from far-flung residences. You know, if this is the end times, Grandma wants us all to be together. Charities that do things only like for long term, I think they would suffer. There would just be less charitable giving. Sports teams, professional sports teams, would probably carry on their seasons, but I'll bet they'd have a problem with renegotiating media contracts. Private colleges that, you know, charge up the wazoo for a bachelor's degree, they would probably fall. The parents have been paying that $40,000 or $80,000 a year on the premise that their kid will then have a career in
something,
science or another.
Right.
And why should they pay all that money rather than just have them go to a technical college or a junior college? So I think private colleges would largely go bankrupt. Police agencies in the short run would see a surge in shoplifting, looting, burglary, as people, you know, store up for what might happen. And I think finally Congress and the state legislatures would just become moot. They don't accomplish much anyway, and why would we even listen to something that's going to occur next year or 5 years from now if we don't know that we'll still be here then?
And I know it's foolish to try to put logic into human psyche, but wouldn't it be logical to think, well, today I find out that there are other beings in this universe, and they're visiting us, and they have been for eons, and it hasn't affected my life at all in the past.
Yeah.
Why should it affect my life tomorrow? But
some people will take that attitude. A friend of mine here said, just another thing to put up with.
It's another thing to put
up. But I don't think everybody would have that attitude.
No.
Initially,
right.
There would be panic and social unrest.
Oh, boy. Okay, so, Mr. Dan Wright, we're running out of time, but please tell us where we can get your book, where we can study more of your work.
On Amazon, and just my name, Dan Wright. I do have the ISBN somewhere here, but I can't put my hand on it right now. But it's on Amazon. It has been since, I guess, September 1 or 2.
And the title again?
The CIA UFO Papers.
Dan Wright, thank you so much for joining us.
And it's been fun.
And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.FM's website. Click on Talk Shows on the home page, then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is UFOImplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative program. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 12 noon, when we will again be exploring the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Yo, guys and dolls, this is Daddy G, and the Mount Shop is moving to a new time slot. 1 p.m. every Tuesday here in WHFR. We're still spinning the platters from the 50s and 60s just an hour earlier. That's 1 p.m. every Tuesday on 89.3 FM. WHFR.FM. Be there or be square.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Guys and dolls, you are at the Malt Shop with Daddy G on WHFR, and we're going back to the 50s and the 60s. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and head on down to the Malt Shop where the jukebox is playing and the kids are dancing. And here we are, back in the 50s.
Cause I'm a one.